Chapter 5 of Green Grey Homestead by Steele Rudd. This Legamist recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Read by Anna Simon. When first you took up the little grey homestead, you counted on growing wheat and barley and maize, and leaving milk alone. Grain growing was more dignified and manlier than strumming on strawberries teats while she chewed her cud and beat time with her tail. And being a bachelor, what all young homesteaders with any real respect for women ought to be, you'd have time to cook yourself good meals and attend to your laundry occasionally, and you'd be able to go for a ride to some of the places on Sunday afternoons, perhaps on holidays as well, if you heard about them in time. Instead of slaving morning, noon, and night, you'd make a white man's job of farming and show a lot of them how to be their own bosses and masters of their own fate. So, contrary to local wisdom and tradition, you start off and plough and harrow and sow, and then pray and wait for the seed to come up and grow, and when it grows, for it to escape blight and all other afflictions that old hands warn you crops are heir to if you don't look out. And after a couple of seasons of ploughing and sowing and the rest, you find you haven't looked out hard enough or something, and then you meditate a lot at night, instead of sleeping, till you lose flesh and look as if you'd been put through a clothes wringer, and you move and mope about like a shell with the life gone from it. When you're out of kerosene and candles at the same time, and you have to meditate and smoke in the dark, it will come home to you what a great part a little illumination plays in the comforts of a homestead, even one like yours. Almost as great a part as little hanging plays in the discomforts of jail life. But it all helps to get you into the habit of going to bed early and beating the birds in the morning, and makes you well versed in the secrets of homesteading, and teaches you how hard it is to stand on your own feet, and that as far as society is concerned, you are fairly in the wilds. At last, when the old hands, who paid dearer for their knowledge than you, keep on shaking their heads and warning you not to leave strawberry out, and telling you that 10 or 12 of her, which would be enough for one man to manage, would mean as many pounds a month regular in your pocket, and at the same time, if you couldn't shake off the habit, you could still keep on ploughing and sowing, you decide on a change of policy, and chance the ducks. So, out of meditating and smoking in the dark, one day comes a close conversation with the storekeeper. You've conversed closely with him before, and found him sympathetic and white all over. You've sold him the remnant of a crop you harvested, and he's got a contra-account against you. It's been against you for 8 or 10 months, and growing faster than the corn did. But he's not reminding you of the account. He's listening to your conversation about strawberry, to the fresh hopes you see in her success, but more especially to the difficulty you see in squaring his bill and buying a few of her from the proceeds of the crop at the same time. And when he says, "That's all right, Dick, don't worry. I'll pay you in full for the corn, and you can buy the cows and repay me monthly from your milk money," your heart will weigh light again, and you'll canter all the way home with your hat hanging to the back of your neck, whistling and feeling like Napoleon hurrying from Elba to mobilize a new army. All that night, cows bulging with milk will trail through your brain, tramping all over you, poking you out of bed with their horns. Herds of them there'll be. Next day, in clean shirt and pants, you'll get across your saddle-horse and ride into Terence Riley's farmyard at milking-time, with a hand fumbling in your pocket, and running your eye over any of his herd that are lying about, like a butcher looking for fats. "Hello, Dick, me boy," Terence himself from under the flank of young Rosie will greet you as your head shows over the yard-rails. "And where is it you're off to?" "Looking for a few head of cows," you'll tell him, dismounting, "if I can pick 'em up cheap enough." "Well, you've come to the right place," Terence will say, winking at the boy in the next bale. "No one ever got anything else but cheap cows from Riley's." And while he empties his bucket and calls to someone to fetch Polly and Kitty and Gooseberry into the yard, you move amongst the soft-eyed creatures, regarding them critically and covetously. "Money wouldn't buy her," Terence, joining you, will declare as you stroke the back of a satin-skinned, companionable little beast. She's purebred, be an imported government bull, and has been giving her 5 gallons for the last 12 months or more. But there's Biddy, standing in the corner there, just as good, if not better, that I'll sell cheap to you. And 'tis only because the farm's carrying more than it should that I would sell her, or any of them at all. 'Tis like parting with me heart's blood. Then you'll examine Biddy, and a host of others that Terence will lead you to, studying them hard. And while you're studying them, and he's fondling them, and reciting pedigrees, a conviction that you don't know so much about dairy cows as you thought you did will grow on you. So far as you can judge, they're all good milkers and super animals. But as to how much milk any of them is capable of giving, and the quality of it, you've nothing but Riley's word to guide you. You know enough, however, not to delude yourself that he's going to dispose of 6 at the best if he can unload 6 at the worst onto you. So, after chopping and changing, you decide to take a half dozen. Beautiful animals, the like of 'em can't be got anywhere in the district. And because Riley never likes to see anyone go away feeling dissatisfaction, you're getting them cheaper than anyone else would get them. Then off you go, the pride of ownership filling you with fresh hopes as you flick those milkers along the lane to your little homestead. You'll be a much prouder man in 12 months' time, though, when a dairy expert visits the homestead and teaches you something about testing and grading, and you learn what Riley himself didn't know, that you bought for a fiver a head, cows worth a tenner and more. You're a man at the milking yard now, and you talk cow and think cow. You're a shareholder in the local cooperative dairying company, too, and every morning, when you deliver your couple of cans and see them weighed, you walk through with hands in your pockets, inspecting the plant and appurtenances, and wondering if the hands are earning their screws, and if the cheesemaker couldn't perform the duties of secretary as well, and save the shareholders 100 or 2 a year. The spirit of the employer will get into your blood, too, and you'll think about engaging a man, one who knows how to handle and work horses, and can milk with both hands, and doesn't mind roughing it a bit until you get further on your feet. "You'll have a hard job to get one," the old hands will tell you. "It's not work, it's waiting on that men want now, until they get a few quid together, and then away they go." But someone tells you that Macpherson found one at the township for a quid a week. A pretty good man he was, only he got sick and had to go away to the hospital. So one day you go off in your new second-hand spring cart to the township, specially to hunt for a man. "There was a chap here only a little while ago," the publican will tell you, "and he was asking about a job, too. He might be just the cove to suit you. Hold on till I see if he's about." And while you hold on, looking up at the bottles and packets of cigarettes and dice on the shelves, and sniffing the odour of stale beer rising out of a cask in a corner, he goes out and yells like a bullock-puncher. He was one, in fact, before going into business. To all who can hear, to tell that rat-whiskered cove he's wanted in the bar, and to look lively. Then, returning, he'll take a murky cloth and start wiping some glasses, and he'll be forecasting the weather for you when the red-whiskered cove, who also has red eyes and a red nose and a red handkerchief, appears, hesitating and staring, as if he suspected it might be April Fool's Day or some other catch. "You were wanting a job, weren't you, Whiskers?" the publican will question, and so great will be the other's relief on finding it isn't April Fool's Day, or that you aren't a policeman, that for the moment he can't remember if he wants a job or not. "Well, this chap wants a man for his farm. There's a chance for you." And the publican will pass him round the counter into your presence and take up the murky cloth again. You'll ask Whiskers what sort of a hand he is amongst horses, if he can plough, and has he ever done any milking. "Horses? Plough? Milk?" Whiskers seems surprised at you asking such questions. "And what about your wages?" Whiskers will leave that to you, but you would rather he stated the figure himself. You're afraid of slipping by mentioning something bigger than he expects. Whiskers has no idea, not having been long in the district. "A quid?" you question, timorously. Whiskers, undecided, turns his red face on the publican in search of guidance. "That's the usual thing." Boniface will lie promptly, more in his own interests than yours, as he places three glasses on the counter. "And you're darn lucky to get it. Now what's it going to be?" Whiskers calls for a rum. Not being a drinking man, you shake your head. "Have a ginger ale, that won't hurt you," the publican will advise, filling his own from a bottle of tea. You change your mind and agree to a ginger beer. The publican lifts his, and wishes you both the best of luck. Whiskers puts his down first, then, telling you he's going to get his swag and will meet you outside, he vanishes. You'll reckon he ought to suit you, and will be turning to the door to go off, when Bung will out with, "That'll be 18 pence." As well as being surprised, you'll get a scare, because money is the last thing you carry about with you. You want all your pockets for carrying washers, and nuts, and nails, and twine, and stuff that comes in handy. But you remember that by a piece of good luck there's a florin somewhere about you that you've been hawking round for months, and you start searching for it. And when you discover it among some binder twine, you toss it on the counter as if you were darn pleased to get rid of it. In your hurry to be off before Bung in his generous way calls for another round of drinks, you forget your change. Arrived at the homestead, you tell Whiskers he can make his quarters in the house along with yourself. Though you're his employer, you don't want to draw a social line or look down on him, and you apologize to him for the untidy state he's found the place in. But Whiskers doesn't mind. He's been accommodated in places a lot worse. So long as there are no fleas, he doesn't care. Fleas keep him awake when he ought to be asleep, and Whiskers will be a man who requires a lot of sleep. And while you're putting the kettle on, and buzzing round preparing a bit of dinner before starting him on the plough, Whiskers will unfold his swag and be making a bed for himself in a corner on the floor. He won't have any sheets or pillows, but he'll sort out his hairbrush and comb and clay pipes and tobacco and matches, and there'll be a bottle which he'll keep covered and handle gently as if it were a baby, and he its mother putting it to bed. When you both have dined, Whiskers better than you, he'll be scurrying around again, returning the butter and bread and beef to their different places in the kitchen, and stacking up the dirty dishes, putting off the evil hour of washing up till night, and at the same time communicating to Whiskers all that it will mean to you if you can, with his help, get 30 acres of wheat under in time for the rain, as some new land broken up before Christmas. And while you're scurrying and enthusing, Whiskers will be standing in the doorway, smoking and agreeing with you, and stepping aside whenever you want to go out or come in. Putting on your hat and closing the door, you'll take him out and introduce him to the plough team. You'll harness them up in his presence, showing him certain marks by which to identify their respective collars and winkers. The back bands won't matter so much. Whiskers won't be listening, but he'll be stroking the horses' foreheads and filling their eyes with smoke and grinning. "Now then," and you take hold of the reins eagerly and start off, driving the team to the paddock. Whiskers will follow, covering you and keeping in step like a soldier. When you weigh the team at the barbed wire gate, he'll weigh too, and stand while you drop the reins and open it. You'll hook them to the plough while he knocks the ashes from his pipe, and taking the handles, you'll go a round or two, giving him hints and calling his attention to little things to keep in view. And all the time he'll be stalking behind you, studying the footprints you're leaving in the moist furrow, and looking back at intervals to see if you're doing straight work. "There you are," you'll gasp at the finish. "Now go ahead," and you'll hand the plough over to him. He'll tighten his hat and dawdle a while, hoping you'll depart to your own job without waiting to watch how he starts his. He would sooner you returned in an hour's time after he's had some practice, but you'll be anxious to see how he shapes. So you'll speak to the horses for him, and off they go. You'll stand watching, expecting to see an exhibition of ploughing, something unusual. And you see it. The plough will start wriggling and jumping, and Whiskers will wriggle and jump with it. And what the mouldboard fails to turn over, he'll be trying to kick over. He'll soon be trying to kick it all over. You'll feel as if you had lost heavily at the races. Then, trying to cheer yourself by remembering that everything is new to Whiskers, and thinking he might do better after a while, you'll go off to the milking yard to fix up another bale. You're putting finishing touches to the bale now, trying to see how it works, humming tunes to yourself, and thinking about bringing the cows in, when loud profanity is wirelessed across the gully to you in waves. Looking through the yard-rails, you see the plough-horses facing one another across the plough, and rearing and shaking their heads and falling back on their rumps. And Whiskers will be running round, first to the tail of one, then to the tail of another. Love me, how you leave the yard and run to the rescue, ripping your pants and your flesh in falling through the barbed-wire fence without being aware of it. Pshaw! And Whiskers will spit when you've pacified the team and collected the broken harness. This is no good to me. Those horses ought to be running with Brumbies. But you won't feel offended. You'll know that men sometimes make a smoke-screen of their tempers to hide incompetency, so you do your best to smile. Later, in the milking-yard, when Whiskers struggles through with one cow while you're polishing off the other five, you'll try to smile again and tell him that you know it's always hard for a man to strike form at first. But Whiskers, on whom bad humour will seem to be settled for good, will tell you it's not his unprintable game. Stock riding is what I've been at, dashing through the mulga on a good horse, throwing scrubbers head over tip and tying them down. Not messing round with blanky plough-horses and cows. After supper, though, when you've washed up and Whiskers is lounging on his bed, stealing swigs from the bottle whenever you go out to the kitchen, he'll be in better humour, and you'll like his company. He'll relate weird accounts of his experiences out west, midst thirst and privation and death. And while he's relating them to you, the wind-haunted trees outside will be swaying and sobbing, and the dog, in fear of lurking dingoes, will be whimpering at the door. "Did ever you read any of the poetry a cove called Boke used to write?" he'll ask. "You haven't, of course, but you've heard some of Henry Lawson." "Not him. This cove, Boke, was a stockman on the Thompson when I was out there. He was a drover and a horseman. And you, living in a hole like this, never read Where the Dead Men Lie? Well, I'll give it to you." And when, to the accompaniment of the moaning trees and the scratching of the dog at the door, Whiskers, his big eyes fixed on you like red mantles burning in the dim light, drolls, "Out where the grinning skulls bleach whitely, out where the wild dogs chorus nightly, under the salt bush sparkling brightly, that's where the dead men lie." You'll think ghosts, and fancy the hand of one is feeling your hair. And just as he concludes, and the dog suddenly shoves the door open, and the wind rushes in, you'll let out, "Hell!" and give a jump. So will Whiskers himself. Next morning. Instead of rushing off, after you call and shake him a number of times, to round up the cows, Whiskers will mope round in a homesick sort of way. And when you tell him cheerfully that you can see all the horses on the ridge side, he'll shake his head and say, "Oh, blimey, boss, I think I'll chuck it in." Of course you're not sorry. You'll be pleased, but you don't want to show your pleasure, so you'll tell him that it rests with himself. "Full pay for yesterday, then, and we'll be quits." You won't object to that, even though he only put in half a day, and a duck-darned bad half. "And you'll rub me up in the cart after breakfast." That'll make you bite your lip, but you'll say, "All right," and confounding him under your breath, you'll go off for the cows. But next day, when you discover that Whiskers had your fancy stockwhip and your razor and snakeskin belt in his swag while you were driving him in, and hoping he'd come and see you again sometime, you'll curse him hard and far above your breath. End of chapter 5.